Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. You probably remember at least one book from your childhood. The Cat in the Hat, perhaps? Goodnight Moon? Where the Wild Things Are? Well, my guest today knows them all. He's chronicled thousands of years of children's literature, from Aesop's Fables to Winnie the Pooh to Make Way for Ducklings. We'll dive in and ask what these books tell us about growing up. This hour, On Point, Children's Literature Through the Ages. Joining me from Stanford, California, is Seth Lehr. He's professor of English and Comparative Literature at Stanford University. He's the author of numerous books, including Inventing English, A Portable History of the Language, and his most recent, A Tour de Force, Children's Literature, A Reader's History from Aesop to Harry Potter. Nice to have you, Professor. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. It's a great pleasure.
So there's hardly a children's classic which you do not discuss in the book. It is incredibly comprehensive. So I guess let's just start at the beginning, shall we? One of the figures that looms largest in the history of children's literature is the legendary Aesop. Why were Aesop's fables ideally suited to these young minds?
Well, it's an interesting question because in many ways, Aesop didn't necessarily begin as a children's writer. And the fables were fables for adults as well as children. But it's very clear that by the sort of high classical period, by the period of the age of writers like Cicero and Quintilian, Aesop really is a writer for the nursery. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading through the hundreds and hundreds of Aesop's fables is how many of these stories are stories of education. Mm-hmm. One of the classics, you know, we all know stories about the animals, about the clever beasts, about the talking animals. And so many of the stories really take as their theme the way in which cleverness trumps brute strength. Mm. And these are really lessons for the schoolroom. Another fascinating fable that I found is about a young boy who steals a writing tablet and becomes a thief. And so what I found in these fables was the way in which so many of them address problems of growing up. They're models for children and parents. And throughout history, the fables get rewritten, they get commented on, they become inspirations for other fictions that are in many ways about tales of growing up.
Hmm. I love that. Aesop's fables, you say, in the book were among the first books actually printed after the invention of movable type.
That's fascinating. Yeah. It's true that what happens at the end of the 15th century is that whenever a printer sets out to print books, one of the first books that the printer prints is an Aesop. And that's true for several reasons. One, because he knows that Aesop will sell. And two, because Aesop is a great authority. And the authority of Aesop redounds to the authority of the printer. And many of these books have wonderful woodcuts and illustrations with charming representations of these talking animals or of these recalcitrant children or of the creatures that come alive and speak. And so they're not just storybooks, they're picture books. Mm.
You say in the book, actually a quote I find fascinating was that in each period of history, the books that children were required to read for instruction or permitted to read for entertainment depended on how their society regarded their offspring. Give us
an example of that. Well, one of the things that I learned in writing the book is that there's no single concept of childhood. And each society, each culture, each period of time has a different notion of the child. And one of the ways of tracing this is to see how books that were originally written for adults, let's say, become recalibrated to children's books. And so Robinson Crusoe is a great example. Robinson Crusoe is really a model for so many children's books after it first appears in 1719. And one of the things that I found very intriguing was the way in which it becomes a chapbook. That is, it's rewritten, it's abbreviated, and it, in fact, becomes one of the most popular children's books in early America, as if America were breaking with a paternalistic Britain, and Americans saw themselves as kinds of Crusoes out there on this island empire now, having to fend for themselves. And so childhood here is invariably wrapped up not just with the childhood of a family, but the childhood of a nation.
In the book, you say that Robinson Crusoe was widely seen as one of the first major novels in English. You categorize it in the island or escapist books chapter in your book, where you say that every backyard is an island empire. Was that kind of work directed mostly toward boys, toward young men then?
I think so, although the thing that I want to stress is that boys and girls were readers of children's literature. And even though there may be some books like Robinson Crusoe that seem very much like boys' books, there are girls' books that take maybe not the backyard, but certainly the study or the room or the classroom as a place of fantasy and imagination. And in the 19th century, there's a French version of Robinson Crusoe for girls, the girls' Robinson Crusoe. So there is a sense in which both boys and girls have imaginative spaces over which they can rule or where they feel themselves in control or as places of imaginative fantasy and experience.
Imaginative places. I love that. Speaking of that, fairy tales, tell us about how they evolved.
Fairy tales evolve in many ways. You know, there are folk tales and there are popular stories, but the fairy tale as we know it is really an invention of the French courts of the time of Louis XIV. They become exemplary stories for courtly behavior, and then they become fables for children. They're adapted into the tradition of Aesop, and some of our great fairy tales and great fables collected by people like La Fontaine or the Grimm brothers, these become national collections. And so by the 19th century, fairy tales were seen not only as books for children, but again, books that go back to the childhood of a nation or the childhood of a people. And in many ways, that's what interested the Grimm brothers in the early 19th century in their collections of fairy tales.
We have a lot of callers already lined up, Seth, to speak with you and to join this conversation. Let's get to one of them first here, Joe. She's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Joe. Welcome.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Jane. I'm a baby boomer, an older baby boomer, and my favorite books were Mr. Bear Squash You All Flat and Lucky Mrs. Ticklefeather. And I found copies of them on eBay recently, and I'm amazed at the vocabulary and the structure, and compared to the newer books, which seem to cater to shorter attention spans, things I learned from, I learned what a puffin was, I learned what a cowcatcher was, I learned what a skyscraper was, and I was probably four when my mother was reading these to me. I found out later that Mr. Bear Squash You All Flat, it greatly influenced Gary Larson of the Far Side cartoons, but children's books, it's such a rich memory for me. That was the best part of getting to stay home sick from school.
Was that
I
would have the exclusive attention of my mother on the couch or in bed reading to me. And those books stand out in my mind. Later on, my brothers were the Cat in the Hat age, the Dr. Seuss age, although I was aware of his earlier books. I think Bartholomew Cubbins and the Hats, about the hats.
Right. And 500 Hats.
Books.
Yeah. Those are all great memories. Joe, thank you for calling. Seth Lair, what about, to her point about stories of old, you learn something from them. How do they compare to children's literature today that may seem, dumbed down for our kids? Is that true?
Well, I don't know if dumbed down is the word. I think the caller makes a couple of important points, and that is, first of all, children's books really not just in the mid-20th century, but from antiquity on, were encyclopedias. Mm. They had new words. They introduced the child reader to new concepts or new things, and they became kind of cultural encyclopedias for the child reader. One of the things that I think was true about the impact of Dr. Seuss was that, as many of your listeners may know, he deliberately limited his vocabulary. And part of the selling point of a lot of the Dr. Seuss books and the I Can Read books that were developed in the 50s and 60s were to get children reading with a relatively limited vocabulary. And so the challenge of Dr. Seuss was, how can you do something brilliant, creative, and imaginative using only 200 different words? Mm. So I think the issue is not so much dumbing down as the issue is constraining the vocabulary as a tour de force, as a challenge. It's like the strength of the genie comes from being confined in the bottle. And the confining for Dr. Seuss was to limit the vocabulary. I wouldn't say also that modern children's literature is necessarily simpler than before, but I think it is true that exposure to media, that use of narrative media such as film, video, and computer animation has changed the attention span and has changed a child's sense of narrative. Hmm. So I think in many ways, children's literature narratively works differently today than it did when I was a child in the 50s and 60s and when your caller was a child, because our expectations of narrative are different.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the history of children's literature. What lessons did you learn through your childhood reading? Which books still stick with you today? Seth Lair is with me this hour. He's professor of English and comparative literature at Stanford University. His new book is Children's Literature, A Reader's History from Aesop to Harry Potter. I wonder, Professor, right out of the gate here, do you think that there's a single golden age or golden era of children's literature?
Well, personally, I don't think so, although I do believe that all of us think that the golden age of children's literature was the time that we were children and reading. just as, you know, people of my generation think that the golden age of cinema was the 1970s when we first started going to the movies. So I do think that there are periods of time, however, when the genre or the forms of children's literature take on a very special and important cultural sense. Mm-hmm. I think it is true that from about 1860 to 1920 in Great Britain, children's books, being a children's author, and childhood itself were socially and culturally valued things. Mm. I think many of what we think of as our great classics of children's literature come from that period. For someone of my generation, the golden age of children's literature is the decade and a half after the Second World War, the age of Robert McCloskey and Dr. Seuss, and the books that for the first time opened up possibilities for the baby boom generation for reading and imagining.
Let's go to the phones now. Tony is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention we have a four-year-old grandson who is not allowed to watch much TV, so he calls every day to be read to by myself, my wife, and his favorite books are Thornton Burgess, and we have probably 50, 60 of them. And I wondered, they seem like kind of a retelling of Aesop, a lot of them do, but I wonder what you think of Thornton Burgess.
Mm. Thanks, Tony.
I think you're right. I think that Burgess, along with lots of other writers, are taking the traditions of Aesop, taking the traditions of the fable, and putting them in a new light for new readers. I mean, my question to Tony would be, for a four-year-old, What else does he like to do? What is his sense of the world that he's getting from these books?
And Tony, you still there? He is gone. Well, do you have grandchildren? I mean, what's your sense from what you hear from children?
Thank you for the compliment, but I'm not that old. I have a son who's...
That's right. You have a 16-year-old. That's right.
I have a 16-year-old son. To my knowledge, I have no grandchildren. But one of the things that I do think emerged from my writing the book was the way in which, in the course of my son's life, reading to him and sharing his experiences really gave me a good sense of what's going on in the history of children's literature. And one of the things in particular, the kind of boy he was and maybe the kind of boy I was the fascination with science and technology. And so the way in which children's books have very often not just a science fiction or a technological fascination, but the way in which science for children has become a new genre in the past 30 or 40 years.
Well, talk about that, because there's a chapter in your book dedicated to, chapter 5, Darwin and science-related literature, how science has influenced children's books.
Well, I think Darwin had a huge impact on children's literature because Darwin created for the popular imagination the notion of evolution, but it was reinterpreted as individual evolution. So for many children's books in the 19th and early 20th century, the question was, does the child evolve? And more importantly, if the child is exposed to, for example, animals or to people of a different social class, will the child devolve? And so Darwin and children's literature is inseparable from the rise of imperial culture in Britain and the fascination with Africa, with India, and with exploration. And so I think what happens is that there's this fascination with science and evolution. And I see Dr. Seuss in many ways as a great sort of Darwinist of the imagination, not necessarily because of the view of evolution, but the idea that it's Darwin on the beagle, it's Darwin exploring, it's On Beyond Zebra, it's people like Peter T. Hooper and Scrambled Egg Super, where he goes all over the world to find strange birds. And we all know that Darwin invented really his notion or came to understand evolution through the study of birds, through the study of those finches.
There's some other great books from that chapter, The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, The Water Babies, Charles Kingsley. And then you link The Origin of the Species to the founding of the Boy Scouts, actually, in the early 1900s.
Right. These are all part of this intersection between Darwinian notions of evolution, popular culture, and British imperialism. And so the question for Baden-Powell in his book Scouting for Boys is, are there individuals who do evolve? Now, remember, we're talking about Britain at the end of the 19th century, where there's the perception that European white men are somehow more evolved or more civilized. I use that in scare quotes, from African or people of African ancestry or people of subcontinental Indian ancestry. And there is a kind of wonderful and, to our mind now, almost horrifying Darwinism about Scouting for Boys. One of the things that I think is really interesting is that the illustrations to a book like Scouting for Boys show us characters who look very much like the characters out of Dr. Seuss, with their receding chins and their big noses and their high foreheads, and juxtapose pictures from Baden-Powell's book and Dr. Seuss. So when you mention Kipling, when you mention Kingsley, these are the classics of 19th century children's literature that are very much informed by notions of social evolution, by notions of individual growth as a kind of evolution, and by the colonial experience.
I've got to get to some of these calls. We have so many lined up. Lisa is first in Boston. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I love reading to my 13-year-old, and he still lets me do it. And we've been reading Sounder and Old Yeller recently. And I was surprised at how adult the themes are, and I guess I hadn't read them in a long time. Themes of poverty and uncertain future and death, and I think that he's totally ready to deal with these things, but you don't find them as much in more contemporary books. And I have also noticed that sometimes in the more contemporary books, they might take an old story and rehash it in a more politically correct way, like they might take The Three Little Pigs but show it to you from the wolf's point of view.
So I know which book you're talking about. Yes.
So I find that interesting because sometimes some of the older themes maybe seem a little bit too frightening for kids now, so they try to rework them so that they seem more, you know, even-handed and not as many sort of scary ideas in them. So,
Lisa, thank you. Thanks for the call. Professor Lair, do you want to respond?
Yes, I think that the caller makes a really important point, and that is that childhood is a frightening time. And one of the things that I think we as parents are afraid of, we're afraid of scaring our children. And if you read books like Old Yeller that she mentioned, if you read Johnny Tremaine, if you go back to the Grimm's fairy tales, one of the things that you can see is that in their unsanitized form, many of these books and many of these stories are truly terrifying, and they deal with what your caller calls adult themes of separation, of poverty, of the family falling apart, of death, of loneliness. And I think that earlier periods of time and different cultures saw children as, in effect, growing up much more early than they do now. Mm. And one of the things that I think many sociologists have talked about today is the way in which we prolong childhood and we prolong adolescence. We're helicopter parents now, and part of what we're doing, helicoptering around, is we're trying to shield our children from the disturbances of everyday life. And children's literature, to some extent, represents that. So I think that one of the things that is interesting about the Harry Potter books is the way in which they are bringing terror back into children's stories.
Mm. Do you think that's why they're so popular?
I think that's part of the fascination with them, is that it's a kind of controlled terror. Mm. But it's a magical, it's a fantasy terror. It's not real terror. Although when characters die, there is an emotional content to it.
Speaking of this frightening time for in young children's lives, one of the great books, great classics, the book for younger children, actually, is Goodnight Moon. And
yes.
You talk about this in your book as it's being so important to bring order to the world of a child. That lists are so important in the context, especially of this particular book.
Lists are, you know, what's amazing is when you read enough children's literature, you realize that it's full of lists. It's full of catalogs. And this goes back to the way in which children's books, let's say the New England Primer from the early colonial period, is a book of lists. The way in which Goodnight Moon is a kind of New England primer for the 20th century. It lists the things of the world. And among the things that it teaches the child is when you close your eyes and go to sleep, these things do not disappear. One of the things that I think is true about a lot of children, and in fact a lot of adults I know, is they think, if I close my eyes, you're not there. And what Goodnight Moon teaches is that the world is there, it's ever present, and that to live successfully and enjoyably in the world, you need to know where everything is in your room. And you need to know that when you wake up, it's still there.
Everything will be there when you wake up. Nancy is on the line from West Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I'm the sculptor who did Make Way for Ducklings in the Boston Public Garden.
Congratulations. Thank you. Yes, and congratulations.
Well, I love this program. I mean, I am so excited because children's books are so important. I also did Lentil, which is where... is in Hamilton, Ohio, where Robert McCloskey was born.
Right.
And you'll like this. I did Aesop's. I did the Tortoise and Hare at the end
Wonderful.
Of the Boston Marathon as a metaphor
oh,
for
my
the
goodness.
Boston Marathon and for
Perfect.
What it is to be persistent. So that I think that my sculptures speak to learning a lesson. And
well, they are classics in Boston.
Scary.
Yeah, I'm actually seeing in my note here you knew Robert McCloskey.
Oh, very well. Of course, I had to get his permission to do these sculptures.
And is it true you're Sal from my favorite children's book, Blueberries for Sal?
Sal is Sally McCloskey. She lives in Maine. She's taken over her father's place up in Maine. And she was down here recently for some things that we're doing. And we're involved in a Mae Massey collection. You must know Mae Massey. She was mm-hmm. the person who really sort of started picture books. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, it does ring a bell, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that collection, we're trying to save this collection in the archives of... It's for some reason, they have not been, what can I say, they haven't been very well
maintained,
taken care of
yeah.
at Emporia yeah. State University. And so we're trying to work with, there's a whole committee, including Leonard Marcus, whom you probably know, too.
Yes.
And we're trying to save these archives.
Well, good for you, and thank you so much for your work, and my goodness, those wonderful statues in Boston Garden. Wonderful.
I say that it's so important. I just have to tell you about the history, and when you talk about social evolution and behavior of kids, I mean, these books are so important in those terms. So thank you so much for this program.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you. And Jane, one of the amazing things about this call is that it brings back Robert McCloskey to me. Mm. These were the books that I really did grow up with. And Make Way for Ducklings, as I talk about in the book, was probably the first real book I truly ever read. And McCloskey had a real gift for showing us how what an artist does. And he was a visual artist. He was a painter and he did the drawings. But what an artist really does in pictures as well as words is recreates a world, not simply represents a world out there, but creates a world from the imagination.
Let's get another call before our break here. Marty is in Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome, Marty.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for allowing me to join the conversation.
Thank you. Go ahead.
What a great topic. You know, my recollection, and I'm really it's more a comment than a question, I think, is I remember being that tall, geeky, funny-looking kid. I was keeper of the pennies and quarters for, I don't know if anybody remembers, the Scholastic Book Service.
Of course.
It was an East Coast thing. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and every month the kids were allowed to order a book from the Scholastic Book Service. And I got to collect the money for that and order those books. I remember my big problem as a child was never really finding stuff, and you were just talking about scary. That was really on level with what I wanted to read. So I was always finding myself sneaking into the adult section of the library and pulling books out of there. And I remember one book that struck me really strongly as a kid that was kind of scary in a realistic way was a book called The Cross and the Switchblade. I think it was later made into a movie with Pat Boone.
Wow, it's taking me back.
There's a need for kids to be faced with things that they aren't, that they don't see in real life. Hmm.
Marty, thank you. Thanks for your call. I appreciate that thought. You remember that book, Seth?
Yes, I do. And, you know, I think Marty brings back a lot of memories for me. One of the things about many of the children's books that I explore is how it speaks to the way in which some children feel themselves as outsiders. Mm. And how can a child be brought into society? How can a child have a particular gift or a particular talent that makes that child accepted or valued? So many of the heroes and heroines of children's books are really anti-heroes or anti-heroines. They're different. Harriet the Spy is a good example of a girl's narrative in that way, where you have the child who perceives of herself as somehow socially excluded, and by virtue of her intelligence or her wit, she becomes accepted in her little society.
You are a scholar, Seth Lair. You're also a parent, as we mentioned, a 16-year-old.
Yes, and not yet a grandparent.
Not yet a grandfather. Apologize. What were your child's favorite books? What did you read to him?
We began with Goodnight Moon. I loved Pat the Bunny, and he loved it too. Although when I first got the book, I thought it was Pat, comma, the Bunny, but it was actually not the name. It was the injunction, Pat the Bunny.
Right.
We read a lot of science. We went through dinosaur books. We went through fable books. We did a lot of Thomas the Tank. One of the things that my son loved were the kinds of storybooks that would generate new stories. Mm. And so when we would read books, he would then ask me to make up new tales on my own. And I think that was for us the origin of our literary bonding.
Another part of the fun. Seth Lair is our guest. His book is Children's Literature. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Way past the wicked witch's day. She's gone where
We're talking about the history of children's literature. I'm joined today by Seth Lehrer. He's a professor of English and comparative literature at Stanford University. His new book is Children's Literature, A Reader's History, From Aesop to Harry Potter. If you'd like to read an excerpt from children's literature, go to our website at onpointradio.org. You will not be disappointed. This is such a comprehensive review, and there's so much to get to. We need 3 hours with you, Professor Lehrer.
Thank you. Thank you. That's thoughtful of you to say.
Talk about the feminine side of children's literature, some of the great female roles in children's works, from Charlotte's Web to Anne of Green Gables, Red Riding Hood, Hermione and Harry Potter.
Oh, this is a wonderful narrative. And one of the interesting points about women and girls in books is that they seem torn. Should they be, in effect, domestic goddesses? Should they stay at home? Should they practice the domestic arts? Should they learn to care and to cook? Or should they make their way out in the world? Should they perform? Should they be on stage? If you read through children's books for girls, really beginning with Sarah Fielding's The Governess, 1749, probably the first novel written for young women, subtitled The Female Academy, you can see that from Sarah Fielding all the way to Harriet the Spy, or to the figure of Hermione in Harry Potter, girls are torn between staying at home and being on stage.
Another point that I wanted to get to was the rise of American children's literature. You say in the book, to a large degree, was inseparable from the rise of the public library.
And I
wish
you'd
describe that connection, because there is that female tie there. A lot of librarians, of course, typically have been women.
Absolutely. That the women of the late 19th and early 20th century who established the children's rooms in public libraries in the great cities were the founders of modern American children's reading as a social habit. Mm. And this was very much keyed, I think, to the kind of reform movements at the end of the 19th century, to movements for socialization, cleanliness, bringing children of immigrant families into the English language, bringing them into the public space of the library. And librarians had a huge impact on what children read. But I think also they had a huge impact on the fictional narratives of children's books. Mm. So many American children's books have scenes in libraries where children discover themselves in the great library, whether it's a public library or an individual's private library. In Little Women, you see old Uncle Marsh and his library, where Joe becomes the great reader. In Johnny Tremaine, Johnny, after his accident, learns to read and experience the world in the doctor's library. And so I think there's a double edge to the role that librarians have played, bringing children into the ambience of reading books, but also providing us with fictional spaces in which we can imagine ourselves coming to terms with language and with life.
It's fascinating. Back to the phones now. Let's get more of these callers in. Carol is on the line from Norwich, Connecticut. Welcome to you, Carol.
Thank you. I had kind of an idiosyncratic introduction to children's literature. My mother was not a native English speaker, and so when I was a young child, I didn't get the classics, but I got them later when I was caring for children as a teenager, and then later in early childhood study in Erickson Institute of Chicago, and working in a preschool and watching the way the teacher I was with used the themes in, you know, young kids' books. The Make Way for Ducklings is a great example, but, you know, helping the 3- and 4-year-olds with their issues, you know, great literature does so beautifully. My personal memories are of the Harvard Classics compendiums of Aesop's and Hans Christian Andersen, and my siblings and I still fight over who has that book.
Right.
We loved reading those in our childhoods. But what I wanted to ask was, John Martin's big books. Dr. Laird, are you familiar with the series? And I was just introduced to them, and my my quick take on them, I haven't had a chance to look at them closely, was that they're kind of what we would say today is politically incorrect. There were some themes in there that were kind of like, it wouldn't fly today except as a kind of a historic specimen.
Carol, thank you. Professor, what do you think?
I think that's a good point. I think that social mores have changed in so many ways that if you want to go with John Martin, or if you want to go all the way back to Br'er Rabbit and to Joel Chandler Harris, I think it's certainly true that there are books for children in earlier historical periods that represent individuals by gender, by class, by race, that have particular themes that we may say now are socially unacceptable or are perceived as representing certain kinds of bias or at the expense of others. And I think part of the challenge of adapting and reading this history of children's literature is to make clear to our readers today, to children and to teachers and to parents, that things were different, that there were different attitudes, and that authors are in very much products of their own time. Mm-hmm. I do want to mention, just going back to what your caller said about Hans Christian Andersen and the importance of those fables, the thing I want to stress is that my interest is not just in English language children's literature. It's children's literature is a world phenomenon. Hans Christian Andersen writing in Danish, French writers, German writers, Italian writers, the traditions of the fable of Pinocchio, in German of Struwwelpeter, that children's literature is a world phenomenon. And that for someone like Hans Christian Andersen, his adaptation into English language children's literature has had a huge impact on our sense of the exotic, our sense of the historical, and our sense of how children grow up. Mm-hmm. The Ugly Duckling is, in effect, one of the great stories of childhood, because are we all ugly ducklings? Will we all grow up into be beautiful swans? And this had a huge impact on me as a child.
Always relatable in some way. Yes. Duncan is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Duncan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was a child of the 60s and grew up with kind of at a transition period, I think, where there were some old books, some of which aren't talked about anymore, Little Black Sambo and things, but really an international kind of selection. I just jotted down a few favorites, Chanticleer and the Fox, with some great block print illustrations, Monroe Leaf, Ferdinand the Bull.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Remy Charlotte kind of came in the 60s with Fortunately, which had some really interesting illustrations. Not a lot of words, but really great imagery. And also Arm in Arm, which was just a bunch of really silly verse, but presented in a really interesting way. Ping, going back to kind of, the international sort of flavor. Leo Leone had some really interesting books with just a little bit of color on a page. It was all that was really interesting, and I really appreciated those growing up. And now I have three children of my own, and
You're reading to them now too, probably. Yeah,
a friend of ours gave us the first Harry Potter within a year of it coming out. So we've read those. I've read them aloud three times, and I'm on my third rereading of The Lord of the Rings.
Ah, wonderful.
Orally, which is a lot of reading.
Yeah, those are big, big, long books. Keep reading, Duncan, and thanks for your call. Let's get another couple in here. Rain is calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Rain, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, I'm pretty young myself. I'm still a teenager. So, of course, Harry Potter is one of the books of my childhood.
Yes.
I think my uncle gave me the first book when I was in second or third grade, and I still love it. Another favorite of mine is The Chronicles of Narnia, which I think one of my earliest memories from childhood was having a snow day. And my mom and I just read the books all day long. It was amazing. We probably got through, like, the first four. But one other book that I wanted to mention that I know a lot of American kids probably haven't heard of, that your guest reminded me of talking about world literature, is that I have this amazing book called Scandinavian Folk and Fairy Tales, and I have a Danish mother. And one time when we were visiting her family in Denmark, the only English book we could find in the whole bookstore was this, called Scandinavian Folk and Fairy Tales. And it's just all sorts of amazing stories, a lot of them similar to the Hans Christian Andersen ones. And I think I've read it over and over so many times, I still love it.
Mm. Well, that's great. Thanks for the memory, Rain. Do you remember that one, Seth?
Well, I do remember so many of the books that she talked about, and I know of the collection Scandinavian Folk and Fairy Tales, and this is a very important point, that children's literature is a world phenomenon, and that many of the forms of children's literature that we think of as very distinctive may not necessarily have originated in the English-speaking world. I just want to mention one aspect of that, and that is the pop-up book, which I talk about, which grew up in the 18th and 19th centuries. But the great pop-up books of the 20th century were made by the Poles and the Czechs after the Second World War. And pop-up books become, in the hands of Eastern European artists and children's writers, social commentaries. It's as if life in communist Europe was a pop-up world. Everything was superficial. Everything was just the surface. And when you got behind the surface, there was really nothing there. There were fantasy travel trips. There were colors for a world of gray and black and white. And there's so much about the pop-up book that I think comes from this Eastern European aesthetic of the 1940s and 50s. We need to think more about how global our children's literature is. I also want to say something about snow days, which for me, too, were immensely important. My son is California-born. He's never had a snow day. And so my question is, what are the places of his imaginative leisure? What are the days when he has the equivalent of a snow day?
Let's go back to the phones. Patrick is on the line from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Sure.
I'm really enjoying your program. I came through it part way, so I don't know if you've covered this or not, but hearing all these stories and books that people have read when they were kids reminded me of, you know, my dad and the books he read, and one that I really enjoyed was The Little Prince. And I found it when I was unpacking some boxes a couple years ago, and I reread it, and I really enjoyed it as an adult, too, and I thought that, you know, sometimes these books are, while they're written for children, they can be really helpful and enjoyable for adults, too, the way they're short, you know, they reach their themes pretty clearly and concisely, and I think they can be, you know, for adults and children alike.
Patrick, great point. Isn't that true, Seth?
Absolutely, and let me say The Little Prince is an essay in the art of understanding. Remember how it begins. The little boy comes across the picture of a boa constrictor swallowing an animal, and he shows it to the grown-ups, and they say, why should anyone be frightened by a hat? Because it looks like a hat. But, of course, anyone who reads the book knows that it's a boa constrictor digesting an elephant. So for me, this shows us two ways of looking at the world. Is the world made up of hats, or is the world made up of boa constrictors swallowing elephants? Is the world comfortable and warm and familiar, or is the world frightening, weird, imaginative, and crazy? This, to me, is the great statement of children's literature and also of two ways of looking at the world. And I'm glad your caller brought us, brought The Little Prince to our attention.
You know, there's so many things to get to. I just wanted to briefly get into the economics of this. I had no idea how lucrative children's literature has become. It's incredibly profitable, isn't it?
It's the most profitable area of book publishing now. And I would argue that children's literature will save the book industry. that in an age when we do more reading on screen than on the page, in an age of media, of digital and visual stimulation, children's books are bringing reading back. I think the great impact of the Harry Potter books has been to take another generation of kids and turn them into readers. And I think that so many of your callers have called attention to the way in which things like Amazon, Alibris, eBay, that they make possible the recovery of the books of our childhood.
Some of the famous children's awards, like the Newbery Medal and the Caldecott Medal, you say in the book, really shaped the canon of children's books, children's literature in the early 1900s.
Absolutely. And so many of these were stories of adventure. They were great travels. The first book to win the Newbery Prize was Heinrich Wilhelm van Loon's The Story of Mankind in 1922, a book about the way in which we travel through history and travel through the world. Books like Dr. Doolittle, another early Newbery winner, or my favorite during the Second World War, Johnny Tremain, another Newbery winner. These are books that have a huge social impact on our notions, not just of childhood, but our notions of American culture in the large.
If you were to write a children's piece of work, what genre would you choose?
Oh, you know, I think about that, and I think that what I would like to do is write a children's book about a child who enters a library and finds a book that has the answers to all things. And no one will believe this child that he, and I say he because I was a boy and my son is a boy, that he finds the answers to all things. No one will believe him. And he becomes someone who eventually saves the earth from a catastrophe because he has the knowledge gained from the book that enables him to control the future. And maybe that's a fantasy about myself as much as a fantasy about being a children's book author. It's my Neverland and my Wonderland.
You are delightful, and what a delightful opportunity it's been to have you speak with us. I'll read Little Peter Cottontail to my 4-year-old and 3-year-old in a different light tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's been a pleasure talking with you and with your callers.
Thank you. Seth Lair is professor of English and Comparative Literature at Stanford University. You can continue the conversation online. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.